Today we're going to stay with this trade issue, beginning with this press conference Tuesday in Washington with President Trump and Sweden's Prime Minister Stefan Löfven.
If I could, my understanding is that the Prime Minister came to you with a message from the European Union Commission President saying, if you put tariffs on steel and aluminum, we'll slap you back with punitive tariffs on bourbon and jeans and the motorcycles that you talk about from Wisconsin. Are you still planning on going ahead with these tariffs? There are some people in your party who have suggested it's not a good idea. And Prime Minister Löfven, what's your perspective on tariffs, and what message did you convey to the president from Sweden and from the European Union? Thank you.
Well, the United States has been taken advantage of by other countries, both friendly and not so friendly, for many, many decades. And we have a trade deficit of $800 billion a year. And that's not going to happen with me. We have been mistreated by many, sometimes fairly, but there are really very few instances where that's taken place. And I don't blame the countries. I blame our leadership for allowing it to happen. When I was with President Xi in China, as an example, we lose $500 billion a year on trade. We have a deficit of approximately $500 billion a year with China. And we're doing things with China, which are very strong, but they understand it. But I was with him, and I said to him in public, I said, look, I'm not blaming you. I blame our people for not doing a better job for allowing this to happen. But it's like that with many countries other than smaller. The European Union has been particularly tough on the United States. They make it almost impossible for us to do business with them, and yet they send their cars and everything else back into the United States. And they can do whatever they'd like, but if they do that, then we put a big tax of 25% on their cars, and believe me, they won't be doing it very long. The European Union has not treated us well, and it's been a very, very unfair trade situation. I'm here to protect, and one of the reasons I was elected is I'm protecting our workers, I'm protecting our companies, and I'm not going to let that happen. So we're doing tariffs on steel. We cannot lose our steel industry. It's a fraction of what it once was, and we can't lose our aluminum industry. Also, a fraction of what it once was. And our country's doing well. The massive tax cuts and all of the deregulation has really kicked us into gear. But I have to work on trade deals. We're working on NAFTA right now. And if we're able to make a deal with Canada and Mexico in NAFTA, then there will be no reason to do the tariffs with Canada and Mexico. But again, other countries, we won't have that choice. And unless they can do something for us. As an example, if the European Union takes off some of the horrible barriers that make it impossible for our product to go into there, then we can start talking. Otherwise, we're going to leave it the way it is. So the fact is, we've been mistreated as a country for many years, and it's just not going to happen any longer.
How do you avoid this escalating? How do you avoid this escalating into a trade war?
Well, we'll have to see. You know, when we're behind on every single country, trade wars aren't so bad. Do you understand what I mean by that? When we're down by $30 billion, $40 billion, $60 billion, $100 billion, the trade war hurts them, doesn't hurt us. So we'll see what happens. You know, you can also take it. In some cases, we lose on trade, plus we give them military where we're subsidizing them tremendously. So not only do we lose on trade, we lose on military. So, and hence we have these massive deficit numbers in our country. We're going to straighten it out, and we'll do it in a very loving way. It'll be a loving, loving way. They'll like us better, and they will respect us much more. Because even they say, right now, they say, we can't believe we've gotten away. I mean, two countries have said, we cannot believe, to be honest with you, we've gotten away with this so long. Now, one of them made that statement before I got elected. He said, I can't believe I made that statement before I got elected. But it's one of those things. We have to straighten it out. We really have no choice.
And Mr. Prime Minister, how forceful was your message to the president on what the consequences will be if he goes ahead with tariffs?
Now, first, trade is a European Union mandate. So we're a member of the European Union. It's a European mandate to handle trade issues. But as a member of the European Union, I think it's important for us to try to find a way to cooperate between the European Union and the United States. I fully understand and respect the President's view that we have to look after his own country, the country that you're leading. I understand that fully. That's my primary task as well. But for me, leading a small country, depending on open trade, the best way for us is to do that with others, because our export equals to 50% of our GDP. So for us, it is crucially important that we have this open and free trade. Today also, I believe that the supply chains are very, very complicated to see. I know that, for example, when we sell our fighter aircraft, which is a very good aircraft, the content is perhaps 50% American. So we want this to be resolved in cooperation. And when it comes to steel, yes, we have an overcapacity in the world. That's obvious. But at the same time, it is China that is producing about 50% of the steel in the world. So and European Union perhaps 10% and less than that. So to summarize, I think it was a pity. Again, it's a European Union mandate, but it was a pity also that the TTIP negotiations ended, because perhaps with negotiations and talks, we can come into a situation where the European Union and the United States can cooperate. I think that would be a very good solution.
Just to add maybe a little bit further, if you talk China, I've watched where the reporters have been writing 2% of our steel comes from China. Well, that's not right. They transship all through other countries. And you'll see that a country that doesn't even have a steel mill is sending us 3% steel for our country. And many countries are doing it, but it comes from China. So China doesn't send us 2%. They send us a much, much higher level than that. But it's called transshipping. So it doesn't look good when it all comes out of China. So they send it through other countries, and it comes to us. And it's putting our steel mills out of business. Our aluminum mills are going out of business. And we need steel, and we need aluminum. And, you know, there's a theory that if a country doesn't have steel, it doesn't have a country. And it's true. So this is more than just pure economics. This is about defense. This is about the country itself. But again, remember this. We lose $800 billion a year in trade. And I think I was elected at least partially on this issue. And I've been saying it for 25 years. Our country's been taken advantage of by everybody. By everybody. Almost everybody. And we cannot let that happen any longer. Not for our companies and not, most importantly, for our workers. So we're not going to let it happen. Please.
Okay. Tina, TT News Agencies.
So, Mr. President, thank you for hosting us. You mentioned that Sweden has helped the United States with North Korea. How do you see your collaboration in the future to create a future peaceful Korean peninsula? How do you see Sweden's role there? How do you both view the collaboration? And as a follow-up to that, as I may, Mr. President, I know that you followed the development in Sweden closely, especially when it comes to immigration politics. Now that you've spent some time with our Prime Minister, how do you view Sweden in general? What is your take and also on our immigration politics? Thank you.
You have a wonderful Prime Minister, I have to say. We've gotten to know each other. Certainly you have a problem with the immigration. It's caused problems in Sweden. I was one of the first ones to say it. It took a little heat, but that was okay because I proved to be right. But you do have a problem, and I know the problem will slowly disappear, hopefully rapidly disappear. But as far as our relationship with Sweden, it's going to be only stronger, only better, both in a military sense, in a trading sense, in an economic sense. You know, Sweden is a I think the largest, the eighth largest investor in the United States. And they like me very much because the market is up almost 40% since Election Day. So I've made a lot of these business geniuses look even better. So they like Trump. But you know, it's been up very substantially. But I believe Sweden is about the eighth largest investor in the United States, and that's quite an achievement.
How about the collaboration on North Korea?
We've been working on North Korea. Sweden has somewhat of a relationship with North Korea. We've been working with North Korea. As I said, Otto was really brought home, unfortunately, in very poor condition. But Otto was brought home largely with the help of Sweden. They're terrific, terrific people. People from Sweden, the Swedish people are fantastic people. I have many friends in New York, in Washington, from Sweden, and they are fantastic people. Thank you.
And Mr. Prime Minister, how do you view Sweden and North Korea and the U.S.?
We have to find a dialogue. I know it's not easy, but that's the way it has to be. It's a very dangerous situation, and we need all to be very concerned about the development of nuclear weapon. But we must look at the peninsula, the region, the world, and this has to do with world peace or something else. So the key actors is obviously the two countries, South and North Korea, as well as the United States and other big countries. They're the key actors. We've said that we can provide, we can be a channel or do whatever we can to see that the dialogue is smooth, not being naive. It's not up to us to solve this problem, but we can definitely, with our long presence on the peninsula, both in south and north. We have an embassy in Pyongyang, for example. We've had that since 1973. So with that relation with North Korea, I believe that they trust us. We're a non-aligned country, military non-aligned country, and I think if the president decides, or the key actors decide, if they want us to help out, we'll be there.
They really have been terrific, really terrific. Sagar and Jetty, Daily Caller, please. Sagar.
Thank you, Mr. President. Since it's my first time before you, I thought you might indulge me with two questions. First, sir, do you believe that North Korea's recent willingness to talk is sincere, or is it an effort to buy time for their nuclear program? And to what do you owe this recent openness to talk?
Me? No, I think that nobody got that. I think that they are sincere, but I think they're sincere also because the sanctions and what we're doing with respect to North Korea, including, you know, the great help that we've been given from China, and they can do more, but I think they've done more than certainly they've ever done for our country before. So China has been a big help. I think that's been a factor. But the sanctions have been very, very strong and very biting. And we don't want that to happen. So I really believe they are sincere. I hope they're sincere. We're going to soon find out.
That you would like to see some change in the people around you. Does that include your Attorney General Jeff Sessions or either of your cabinet secretaries?
No, I don't really talk about that. I just said that the White House has tremendous energy. It has tremendous spirit. It is a great place to be working. Many, many people want every single job. You know, I read where, oh, gee, maybe people don't want to work for Trump. And believe me, everybody wants to work in the White House. They all want a piece of that Oval Office. They want a piece of the West Wing. And not only in terms of it looks great on their resume, it's just a great place to work. It's got tremendous energy. It's tough. I like conflict. I like having two people with different points of view, and I certainly have that. And then I make a decision. But I like watching it. I like seeing it. And I think it's the best way to go. I like different points of view. But the White House has a tremendous energy, and we have tremendous talent. Yeah, there'll be people, I'm not going to be specific, but there'll be people that change. They always change. Sometimes they want to go out and do something else, but they all want to be in the White House. So many people want to come in. I have a choice of anybody. I could take any position in the White House, and I'll have a choice of the 10 top people having to do with that position. Everybody wants to be there. And they love this White House because we have energy like rarely before. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Please. Prime Minister, last year you criticized the president for drawing a link between immigrant crime and the recent arrivals of refugees. This week, one of our own flagship papers, the New York Times, actually profiled a link between hand grenade violence and immigrant gangs in your country. Do you stand by your criticism of the president?
First, Sweden, we have our share of domestic challenges, no doubt about that. So, and we inherited a legislation that was not sustainable, legislation on migration, which meant that in 2015, we received 163,000 refugees seeking refuge. Bear in mind, we're a country of 10 million inhabitants, so that was a lot. 70% of them came from September to December, which meant it was a dramatic increase. We changed the legislation, so now we have decreased the number of refugees entering Sweden, and we're also putting pressure on the other European Union countries to take their share of the responsibility. This is not a responsibility for one, two, three, or four countries. It is a shared responsibility. We're working with that now within the European Union. We also have problems with crime, organized crime in Sweden, shootings. But it's not like you have these no-go zones. We have dealt with it. I'm dealing with it every day, allocating more resources to the police, more policemen trained, more resources to the security police, tougher law on crime, tougher law on terrorism, supporting terrorism. So we do a lot to combat that. And we can also see some results now in our three major cities. Decrease shootings because we're attacking the organized crime very tough, and we'll keep on doing that because there is no space in Sweden for organized crime because they decrease freedom for ordinary people. At the same time, Sweden have a high growth. Unemployment is going down. Employment is going up. We have high investment rates. We're allocating resources to the welfare. We have a strong, strong economy with a surplus, huge surplus that we're now using to develop our society with, for example, the welfare that we want. So the picture of Sweden need to be, it's two pictures. Yes, we have our share of domestic problems and challenges, no doubt about that. But we're dealing with them, and we also have a good foundation for dealing with them, not least with the strong economy and the shrinking unemployment. Okay, so it's Kajsa, Swedish Radio.
Thank you. This is an election year for both of our countries, and I want to ask you, Mr. Trump, what do you think Sweden should learn from how the Russian influence campaign affected the presidential election in the U.S.?
Well, the Russians had no impact on our votes whatsoever, but certainly there was meddling, and probably there was meddling from other countries and maybe other individuals. And I think you have to be really watching very closely. You don't want your system of votes to be compromised in any way, and we won't allow that to happen. We're doing a very, very deep study, and we're coming out with some, I think, very strong suggestions on the 18 election. I think we're going to do very well in the 18 election, although historically those in the White House have a little bit of a dip. But I think we're going to do well because the economy is so good and because we're protecting our job, like our jobs are being protected finally, like with what we're doing with the tariffs. But the big thing would be the tax cut and the regulations cuts. Also, the judges. I mean, we have outstanding judges, Judge Gorsuch in the Supreme Court, and many, many judges going onto the bench all over the country. So I think we're going to do very well. And I think it'll be a tremendous surprise to people how well it's the economy is so good. Jobs are so good. Black unemployment, Hispanic unemployment at all-time lows. I mean, we're really doing well. So based on that, I guess we should do pretty well, and I hope so. But you have to be very vigilant. And one of the things we're learning is it's always good. It's old-fashioned, but it's always good to have a paper backup system of voting. It's called paper, not highly complex computers, paper. And a lot of states are doing that. They're going to a paper backup, And I think that's a great idea. But we're studying it very closely. Various agencies, including Homeland Security, are studying it very carefully.
But are you worried about Russia trying to meddle in the midterm election?
No, because we'll counteract whatever they do. We'll counteract it very strongly. And we are having strong backup systems. And we've been working, actually, we haven't been given credit for this, but we've actually been working very hard on the 18 election and the 20 election coming up. Thank you very much.
Mr. Levin, are you guys on the same page when it comes to evaluating the threat from Russia when it comes to meddling in elections, you think?
Well, we both agree upon that the election in a country should, the result of the election in a country should be decided by nobody else but the voters in that country. And that is also our clear stance. And that is why our intelligence agencies now also increasing their own capacity to detect and counter, whether it's hacker attacks or financing or producing or spreading propaganda, whatever it is. We are increasing our capacity to handle that. We are cooperating with other European Union countries. Some of our agencies are also cooperating with American counterparts. And this we will continue to do. And so any foreign power that believes that it can interfere with our election, we will find out and we will call them out very clearly and loud.
The first time that you two meet, just the two of you, where did you find most common ground and where do you differ most on political issues?
We
maybe almost everything.
Yeah. We both come from outside politics into politics. I've spent perhaps 30 years in industry as a welder, but also as a trade unionist, but a trade union leader, spending 75-80% of my time cooperating with the company leaders, with the employers organization, in an effort to strengthen our industry. So that's perhaps a similar background, not similar because it's different, but we come from outside politics. But of course, also friends differ from time to time. The Paris Agreement, the importance of Paris Agreement, we stand by that. We think it's very important that we implement and fulfill the Paris Agreement because of the climate issue. And on that, we might differ, tariffs as well. But having said that, still, we know that the relationship is so good, yes, so we can take that we differ as well, because the values are there and we cooperate very, very good on economic issues, making sure that we create jobs and growth, and also on security issues, both when it comes to combating terrorism, but also when it comes to defend ourselves.
Just finally, follow up for Mr. Trump. Do you think that trade is where Sweden and U.S. differ most right now?
Oh, I think we have very good relationships on trade. We have had, and we are constantly in touch. We have, on the military, great cooperation, including design of various components of aircraft, etc. And we were discussing that. We have some of the great makers of these components in the room with us today. Now, we have a very good relationship on trade, and we always will have. Sweden's a great country. It's small, but it's very sharp, I will tell you. They are very sharp. Thank you very much, everybody. I appreciate it. Thank you.
President Trump's comments were addressed by several officials of the European Union. In this press conference Wednesday, the European Commissioner for Trade, Cecilia Malmström, answered questions.
I will open the floor with Philip, please.
Either read or heard the comments from Mr. Trump yesterday. He was saying the EU was very, very unfair. It was almost impossible for us, as in the US, to do business with them. He also raised the possibility of tariffs being put on cars. So maybe you could just respond to his comments, particularly first, in relation to how you think the trade rules, whether they're fair, the EU is playing fair, and second, if the EU carries out these measures, is there not a kind of almost inevitably a trade war that will result?
We should be very careful with that word. That is not in anybody's interest. There are only losers in that. And that's why we will respond, if needed, in a proportionate and balanced way. I looked also at the press conference yesterday from the White House with the Swedish Prime Minister. And there are different things being discussed. The car issue is not being discussed in the section 232. But nevertheless, I heard what the President said. There are almost, I think, only 2 million cars produced in the U.S. by European companies. They give European American jobs. They are a majority of them are exported, so they give revenues to the American economy. Between the EU and the US, there are not very high tariffs. It's not on the tariff side that the main obstacles are in our trading with each other. But it is true that cars have a slightly higher tariff in EU than in the US. But on the other hand, trucks, for instance, have a much higher tariff in the US. So these are things we were looking at in the TTIP negotiations to try to get rid of this. So I think on the car issue, this is not based on facts, and we'll be happy to provide you and the American, we have done that already with the facts on this, because the truth is that that is creating a lot of American jobs.
Georgi.
Georgi Gotov, you're active. Commissioner, you mentioned measures to offset the losses that may be incurred on the EU side, and the names of certain products have already been mentioned in the press. I wonder if, for example, bourbon whiskey is concerned. What would be then? What will happen to the imports in the United States of Scotch or Irish whiskey? I mean, there will be an escalation, and there is also a slight. A perception that certain products are concerned because those are constituencies, basically redneck constituencies.
Thank you. There is a provisional list being discussed. It will now be shared with member states, and in a very short time it will be made public, because we need to consult on that list. So all stakeholders will have the possibility to have opinions on that. That is the rules of the WTO before there is a final list. There has been I think President Juncker even mentioned a few products such as whiskey and others. I would say that on the list there are steel products, there are industrial products, and there are agricultural products. And certain types of bourbon is indeed on the list, as is other items such as peanut butter, cranberries, orange juice, etc. Very soon that list will be public, so you will have you will be able to plan your whiskey drinking.
Oliver.
Hello, over here. Oliver Grimm with the Austrian newspaper Die Presse. Commissioner, are you confident that probably all this talk of trade war coming out of the White House will probably ebb after the special election next, I think, Tuesday, in a little district in Pennsylvania where there are about 17,000 steel workers, and where Mr. Trump is trying to sort of play to an audience that is very much in favor of protecting American steel jobs? So do you think, since he hasn't formalized this, since there's quite a chaos in the administration, it wasn't coordinated with any of his departments except for Mr. Ross. Do you think that possibly this is just a bit of a rhetorical exercise, and that maybe, you know, next week onwards, we're going to be sort of not talking about this anymore? Thank you.
Well, I think your guess is as good as mine on this. It is very hard to speculate what will happen. I note that the discussion on this is very high in the US as well. There are many people in the US who are also not convinced that this is the best way to go about, and have said so publicly, including the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. So I don't know whether this will actually happen or not. I note that it is an electoral promise by the President, and that he has said that he would do this very forcefully the last 2 days. But I don't want to speculate. I truly hope that this will not happen, because a trade war has no winners. And if it doesn't happen, the better. Then we can work with our American friends and other allies on the core issue of this problem, overcapacity. But if it does happen, we will have to take measures to protect European jobs and workers.
Emre.
Thank you very much. Emre Peker with the Wall Street Journal. Commissioner, some member states...
Gospa komisarka, nekatere države članice in trgovinske partnerice ZDA skrbi, da tudi Evropska unija morda malce skuša ubiti pravila STO s tem, ko grozi s protiukrepi. Medtem, ko predsednik Trump govori o nacionalni varnosti. Kakšno je tveganje, da bi protiukrepi Evropske unije ne bili v skladu s pravili STO in bi jih potem izpodbijali? In ali bodo trgovinske partnerice EU, kot so Japonska, Kanada, Kitajska, lahko odstopile od sodelovanja, ker jim ne bo všeč tako protiukrepanje? Vem tudi... da se pogovarjate s trgovinskimi partnericami in zanima me, kdo je za enkrat podporil strategijo Evropske unije, je pripravljen obrati isti pristop in kaj se zgodi, če velike partnerice, kot recimo Japonska, Avstralija in tako naprej, ne bodo podprli pristop Evropske unije. Ja, več vprašanj ste zastavili. Prvič, komisija seveda zelo tesno sodeluje z državami članicami Evropske unije. Bila sem na neformalnem zasedanju sveta za industrijo v Bolgariji prejšnji teden in vse so podprle ta naš pristop. Države članice so tudi videli okvirni seznam in ves čas jih obveščamo o nadaljnih korakih in našem razmišljanju, tako da vse vedo. Potem skladnost s pravili STO, spravno službo komisije skušamo seveda najti načine, ki bodo popolnoma v skladu s pravili STO, da bo vse skupaj vodotesno. In ali se pogovarjamo z drugimi partnericami? Ja, z mnogimi. Tudi te partnerice, tako kot mi, seveda še čakajo, kaj se bo dejansko zgodilo in razpravljajo v svojih kabinetih o teh temah. Ne bom rekla, da katera druga država ima kaki jasen načrt, ki ga lahko takoj razkrije. Vsi razmišljamo, vsi čakamo. Verjetno nekateri tudi gledajo to današnjo tiskovno konferenco in skušamo se koordinirati. Ponekod smo bolj učinkoviti kot druge. Nekatere države, nekatere partnerice so pripravljene podpreti naš pristop, tudi sprejeti take ukrepe, spet druge še razmišljajo.
You have to push the button, please.
Yeah. Naslednje vprašanje.
You seem very confident in the fact that if you take
a... Ja, zdite se zelo prepričani, da če boste šli pred STO izpodbijati trditev ZDA, da gre za vprašanje nacionalne varnosti, da vam bo STO pritrdila. Zakaj? Na podlagi česa ste tako prepričani?
This section 232...
Ta razdelek 232, ki zadeva nacionalno varnost, v primeru Evropske unije in nekaterih drugih držav ni relevanten. Kako lahko tako majhen, tako omejen uvoz jekla iz EU, še posebej, ker gre za tako kakovostno jeklo, ki ga ZDA potrebujejo, kako je lahko to nevarno za nacionalno varnost? Tako da res ZDA težko prepričajo v svoj prav.
Just wondering whether that dispute would be the first time that you would be questioning a national security pretext in front of the WTO. A lot of legal experts say that would really undermine the WTO if you pressed ahead with that. Do you agree with that?
We will take very severe, as we do, legal advice in formulating that request for a panel in the WTO and possibly again with other partners as well who are also looking into this.
The lady here in the front. You have to push the button, sorry.
Is that working? Siobhan Kennedy, Channel 4 News in the UK. Commissioner, you are saying that you are looking to retaliate, not escalate.
I did not use that word. I said rebalance.
Yesterday you talked about this is not escalation, it's retaliation. Well, I just wonder, surely by listing iconic American items, Levi's, peanut butter, Cranby, orange juice, etc., that you are doing exactly that. This is escalating the situation rather than seeking to turn the volume down. Are you worried that that's how it will be perceived? And secondly, I wonder, net-net, is the departure of Gary Cohn overnight a good thing or a bad thing for the EU position?
I am not commenting on the different entry and departures of the White House. On your first question, as I said, we are eager not to escalate this. We do not want this to go out of proportion. But the measures that they are possibly, I still hope that we can avoid it, and we're doing everything we can to try to offer a dialogue. If they are being taken, it's potentially a very severe blow to our European economy. So we are calculating the possible injury that will make to the EU economy, and in different stages we will then take these rebalancing measures in full transparency, analysing what the effects are. We can choose to decide on the list. We can have it ready. We can notify and have it ready, but we can also choose to wait a little bit to see how things develop. But we need, if we want to comply with WTO, to act quite swiftly on the procedural side of this. And we have no intention of escalating, but we can also not just stay silent when such a major a major measure will be taken to the European economy, potentially.
Christopher. It's working now. Commissioner, what is it that the Commission specifically wishes to target by putting these very products on the list? I'm going to give you an opportunity also to answer that question in Swedish. Vilken är tanken bakom just de här produkterna har valts ut och hur är det tänkt att detta ska slå?
I can ask, answer it first in English and then in Swedish. The measures is a split between industrial products, steel products and agricultural products. And we have looked at American products, obviously, but also where there is an adequate alternative supply for EU users, so it wouldn't hurt European consumers too much. Vi har tittat på värdet av...
We have looked at the value of the possible effect for European economy, the negative effects, and we've identified products, steel products, industrial products, and agricultural products, and we've looked at products where there is an alternative for the European consumers.
Hey, Quentin Arias for the Washington Post. Just here. Sorry. Like several U.S. officials have warned in the U.S., like the new tariff from Donald Trump could threaten national security in the U.S. Do you agree with this statement? And can you also, do you have concrete example on how so? And the other question, it seems the tariff you are proposing, like peanut butter, bourbon and so on, are merely symbolic and maybe less harmful than what the EU could face with steel and aluminium. So are you going to speed up and maybe to stress other measures in the coming weeks, or what are your plans?
As I say, we will do three things. We will take this case to the WTO, possibly with other allies. We will have safeguard measures on our steel and aluminium industry. And thirdly, we are looking at rebalancing with safeguards on other products. And that list has been carefully elaborated with the services internally here and also in dialogue with member states in order to correspond to a level of economic hurt that our industry will take. That list is still a provisional one. We are discussing it with member states, and as I said, it will be public very soon, so you can all look at the different items there. And the industry, the stakeholders, will have possibilities to give comments. Of course, we have already spoken to many of them to see if we might adjust the list. So that is very much a work in progress. And on your first questions, no, we do not agree that steel imports from Europe pose a national security threat to the United States. That's why we are here.
We might have time for a couple more questions. I'll give the floor to Michael.
Michael Peel, Financial Times. A couple of questions following up on themes that people have already talked about. One is the politics of this, that how much debate internally is there on the politics of this and the fact that you have a president in the US who has already made it clear that he at least will threaten to retaliate if there's any retaliation from this end, and that therefore because of the nature of the Trump administration and the hawkishness that people talk about Mr. Cohen leaving overnight, that there's a real risk that that will just catch light, whatever you might think you're doing and however reasonable you think you're being. And the second question is, isn't this whole thing fraught with traps for you? And I can think of at least three here. One is the fact that your argument that this is the national security justification is bogus is an assumption, and that technically there is the legal risk that you will be, your own measures might be found illegal. Secondly, safeguards in case of diversion of US products could annoy your allies elsewhere in the world. And then thirdly, I mean, the idea of taking the case to the WTO, of course, fraught with dangers. You yourself, and it's been widely observed how problematic, how the WTO is creaking at the moment. And of course, part of the reason for that is the US actions towards it, particularly on judicial appointments.
Thank you. I think your first questions were more of a philosophical character and maybe not time to go fully into that. We are, of course, seeing what's happening in the US. We are not happy about this possible decision, and we might disagree with a few other measures taken, but the US is our friend and ally. We are working on a variety of issues, and we will continue to do so. And that is why we would hope that the US would engage with us, because we are also concerned about overcapacity, in particular in steel, but also in other products, and that some countries are not following the global rule book. And we have tools, we have fora where we work on this. We are willing to discuss whether they need to do anything else on this, and that the dialogue continues with the US and will continue. As I said, on a variety of other issues, we are working with the US. On the WTO capacity and compatibility, as I said, we are taking very serious legal advice on this. We're looking very closely into the issue to make sure that the steps that we will eventually take are compatible with WTO, and that we feel that we have a very strong case. On the safeguards, we are consulting with the biggest steel exporters to the US. Our allies are also affected by the list to make sure that we calibrate and that we do the design, the measures, so that we not have the effects that you were alluding to, because that would, of course, be highly unfortunate if we were hitting other partners in our efforts to protect ourselves. But we need to take certain measures if this will happen. It risks a serious blow to the European economy and to our workers. I can only note that a similar thing happened in 2002, as some of you might recall. It was not a good thing. It costs thousands and thousands of American jobs as well, so I hope that someone in the White House has read the history book.
We have to wrap up before the college readout. We have time for one very last question. Joanna.
Yes, ladies as well. Yes.
Thank you very much, Joanna Szpilska. And let's a question, Commissioner, on the time frame of the implementation of the countermeasures. First of all, how fast do you want to take a decision? And second, are you going to implement all these tariffs on the U.S. products, these products that you selected already immediately? Or, as you mentioned, possibly in stages? Thank you.
Yes, the issue of sending the case to the WTO, that can be done as soon as we are ready with our legal analysis and prepare that. So that can be done quite quickly. The other things, the safeguards and the rebalancing measures, obviously will take a little bit more time, around the process is around 2 months. And as I said, we can decide to do it on the rebalancing measures, but we can also wait. We have to announce it to the WTO within 90 days and have the whole list published and consulted and so on. But we can choose to withhold if we want to see how things develop in the market and our dialogue with the US. And we are also planning, if we take it, to do it in two stages. That depends, of course, if the measures are implemented, the effect of them, and how long they are there for, because that is also not clear what they are planning to do, if this is a temporary measure or if it's going to drag on for quite some time, because then the effects on the European market will kick in, maybe, you know, not all at the same time, but it will take longer. And in this, we are working very closely with the industry to get their analysis and their prognosis as well.
It has been a busy week at the State Department. On Thursday, the usual State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, sat down with Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan, who had just returned from a trip to Europe.
I wanted to talk with you about your most recent trip to Europe. You got a lot of good attention for the work that you were doing. Tell us a little bit about some of your stops. First off, you went to Germany.
I did.
For the Munich Security Conference. Tell us about that.
The first stop, as you mentioned, was in Germany, a very large conference in Munich called the Munich Security Conference. It's been going on for almost 70 years at this point, 60 years. It's grown into quite a collection of diplomats, statesmen, leaders, NGOs that talk about security issues of primarily of European focus, but now more of a global conference. I had a number of bilateral meetings while I was in Munich, both with European officials, but also I met with officials from China, Sudan. But I went to the conference. I participated in a panel discussion on our nuclear posture review with representatives from Russia, China, South Korea, and Estonia. And that panel, my principal focus on that panel was to discuss our nuclear strategy, which has a number of common features that have been part of U.S. Policy for decades. Commitment to nuclear nonproliferation, to arms control, to our moratorium on nuclear testing, and our commitment to deterrence. And it was a lively discussion. Principally because our nuclear strategy, the nuclear posture review, describes a new security environment that the United States faces with increasing threats from, among others, North Korea and Iran, more traditional threats that continue from Russia, and now China. So the security environment has changed since our last nuclear posture review in 2010, and my job was to explain that new security environment that we face, how our nuclear posture review reflects our response to that, but to reaffirm our commitments to all those basic values that we've committed to as Americans for decades, as I say, nonproliferation, arms control, moratorium on arms testing. So that was Munich. Mm-hmm. And
any other issues that came up of great concern to our European partners and allies?
We talked a lot about more specific issues. For example, the Germans are very focused on the ongoing discussions to form a new government. Chancellor Merkel's discussions to form a grand coalition. We spoke with German government officials about that. I spoke with Archbishop Gallagher from the Vatican about issues of concern to the Vatican, their discussions with the People's Republic of China, but the Catholic Church in China.
Probably human rights issues, human rights religious issues, freedom.
Religious freedom and how the Vatican will interact with the Chinese government and the Chinese Catholic Church in the PRC. So a number of different individuals that I was able to get time with to speak with while I was there in Munich, all of whom had come for this security conference. So they're all gathered in one place, and it's an opportunity to have conversations with all these different officials.
It sounds like certainly time well spent.
Yes, indeed.
I know from Munich you went on to Italy, where you had some bilateral meetings with Italian officials, and you also spoke before some other groups there?
I did. And in Italy, again, the Italians have elections coming up on March 4th. Talking to Italian civic leaders about their views on the election, what they think will happen. Meetings with the Italian government officials to talk about issues of mutual interest, including migration from Libya. Italians have played a leading role in trying to stop the dangerous migration from Libya, where we've seen people drown, adults, children drown, and trying to make the trek from Libya to Italy and southern Europe. So we talked about that. We talked about Ukraine, which was the next stop on my trip in Europe. I went to Kyiv. But we talked to the Italian government about the need for continuation of sanctions on Russia over their intervention in eastern Ukraine and annexation of Crimea.
And so they share our concerns with regard to that. Do they have sanctions of their own?
The EU does, and as part of the EU, we were I was discussing with them the need for the EU to continue their sanctions on Russia over Ukraine and in particular Eastern Ukraine and Crimea. In general, I was there to reaffirm the U.S. commitment to the transatlantic alliance, to NATO, to our EU partners and allies. And it was the fact that, I should have mentioned this at the outset, I think it was among the largest delegations the U.S. has ever sent to the Munich Security Conference. Again, a reaffirmation of the U.S.'s commitment to our NATO allies, to our EU partners and allies. Secretary Mattis was there, Director Pompeo, myself, a number of senators and representatives, very large U.S. presence. So in my trip to Italy, it was again to reaffirm our commitment both to our bilateral relationship with Italy and with NATO and the EU.
I hope you got some good food along the way, though, too.
There was good food.
I mean, hard to not say that about yes. Italy, and that's okay. Well, so from there, then you went to Ukraine.
Ukraine.
And it was really an important relationship for the United States.
Two messages, yeah. Two themes in Ukraine. Support for Ukraine in resisting Russian aggression in eastern Ukraine, and our non-acquiescence, our opposition and support for Ukraine in resisting Russia's annexation of Crimea, mm-hmm. One theme. Second theme was assisting Ukraine, providing support to Ukraine in the Ukrainian people's and government's effort to reform the government, to eliminate corruption, mm-hmm. to shed the shackles that have really held back Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian economy that they inherited from decades of life under the Soviet system, and then in the decades since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the corruption that still lingers.
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure.
That was one of your primary messages, and they've been making progress. And the United States always encourages countries to do more on that front, to encourage businesses to come in and to be able to invest, but to have good and free societies. They've made some progress in recent years.
They have. They've made a lot of progress in restructuring their government and restructuring their economy. But there's more to do, mm-hmm. and we want to help. Mm-hmm. They have adopted a new investigative unit to investigate corruption and an independent prosecutor's office to prosecute corruption cases. What they need now is a corruption court system, which their legislature is considering. I was there to advocate for their adoption of this anti-corruption court, mm-hmm. as part of yet another step in their effort to reform the government and fight corruption.
And one of the things you also talked about was Ukraine's territorial integrity.
Yes.
And fighting Russian aggression. And you put out some pretty strong messages,
right.
and statements on that. Tell me about why you're passionate about that, why you feel so strongly about that.
Well, Ukraine faces a difficult transformation in reforming itself, in fighting corruption, reforming its institutions. That process, which we support, is made doubly difficult, really difficult, by the external aggression they face from Russia and Russian proxies in eastern Ukraine and the Donbass, who are, it's a daily a drumbeat of violence in eastern Ukraine, Ukrainian soldiers killed and wounded.
Plus civilians
as civilians
well,
as
and
well,
we've seen
of
those,
course.
Those horrible the
images,
monitors.
Yes. And plus the Russian annexation of Crimea. Mm-hmm. So beyond that, it's really a hybrid effort by the Russians, because it's not merely a military effort, but a cyber effort as well. We announced shortly before I arrived in Ukraine the attribution of this cyber attack that started in Ukraine called NotPetya, yeah. which started in Ukraine but spread around the world and caused
to the UK,
billions of dollars in damage.
Mm-hmm.
But it was focused originally in Ukraine, and our sense is that Russian actors use Ukraine as a laboratory for these types of malign activities. So I was there to stand with the Ukrainians in resisting this aggression. and to offer our support in any way we can in their efforts to reform their government.
Yeah, in standing with the Ukrainians, you also went to a memorial for
I
the
did.
Heavenly Hundred.
It was
Hundred.
Very moving, yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, it was very moving to see the both the memorial for those who had been killed during the so-called Revolution of Dignity at Maidan Square, young people who were killed by Ukrainian police and armed forces. And there's a second memorial with an even larger number of Ukrainians who were memorialized there, who've lost their lives in the fighting in eastern Ukraine. Mm. Pictures of all the soldiers who have been killed in eastern Ukraine. So it's very moving to see that. It's there are still fresh tributes brought every day, candles, flowers, and so forth, from family members who lost their loved ones in the original revolution in Maidan Square, and then in the violence that's continued in eastern Ukraine.
That means so much to those countries for you to pay your respects in that kind of way, to learn more not only about what that country has gone through, but to personally, as a face of the U.S. government, go out there and say, I value you, I value your sacrifices, and here I am.
Yeah. It's important for, particularly for Americans, to come and stand with allies and partners in Europe, and particularly in Kyiv, the Ukrainians and the men and women in the Ukrainian government are under such pressure mm-hmm. to achieve results for their people, but to do so while they also face the threat of aggression from the east, from their neighbor Russia. So it makes it doubly difficult for them.
And I think as regular Americans, we often don't appreciate just how much sometimes our thanks, our presence, just showing up means to those countries.
Absolutely.
I know many of our Foreign Service officer colleagues would certainly know that, but for regular folks around America,
sure.
I think it's something they don't always recognize.
Absolutely.
So thank you for going there and doing that, certainly.
Sure.
Then you went on to Latvia.
Riga, Latvia.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Beautiful weather. The sun was shining. It was chilly. It was cold. But it was a great visit to stand with the Latvians, who also face a threat on their eastern border, which they see every day from Russia. It was an opportunity for us to reaffirm the commitment of NATO to the defense of Latvia, our Article 5 obligations for defense of NATO member countries, reaffirming that for them. There was also, while I was there, discussions about certain actions that were taken by the Department of the Treasury against a Latvian bank.
Oh, that's principally that made big news here while
right,
you're away.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I was able to have discussions with senior Latvian government officials, reaffirm our partnership with them, to work with them to address concerns about money laundering and the strength of their financial system. So it was a good opportunity for me to share those thoughts with senior Latvian government officials.
And then after that, you went on to Brussels, right?
Brussels for, it was a conference that was hosted by the EU, but the focus was on the Sahel and the G5 Sahel Force, which has been created by these five Sahel nations to address terrorism concerns with ISIS and other terrorist organizations that threaten that region. And it's a very, it was a remarkable collection of countries that came, not only the members of the EU, but the United States was there, countries from around the world, united in support of the G5 countries that are undertaking, with the support of the United States, the EU, France has played a leading role in this area as well, to support them as they work to defend their territorial integrity, protect their countries, to help stop the flow of migrants through the Sahel to places like Libya, where they would continue on to southern Europe in a dangerous transit across the Mediterranean, and trying to address not just the security threats, but also the underlying economic and social forces that drive people to want to take those risks, to cross, leave their homeland, cross the Mediterranean to try to get to a better life, try to address those concerns in the Sahel.
That's certainly so a lot.
There was a conference there, and it was hosted by the EU, but there were a lot of other countries in addition to EU member countries that was there, and I was honored to represent the United States.
Mm. How did you find your reception overall? All these places, you went to a lot of places in just a few days. You must be exhausted, but the overall reception.
Well, Europeans, European allies and partners, welcome reaffirmation from the United States of the value of our relationship, and that was the principal thrust of my visit, was to reaffirm the importance of that transatlantic relationship, and it was a very receptive audience. They really particularly want to feel that embrace from the United States, and that's certainly the case in Kyiv and Riga, to know that the United States is standing with them when they face such external threats, in addition to internal problems which they need to solve.
Well, you've now been coming up on your time here at the State Department almost a year now, a year in May. Right? And what has surprised you about being here?
I was asked that question. I do town halls at every embassy I visit, and somebody asked me that question. And what has surprised me about the State Department, most surprised me, what I hadn't expected was how small in some ways the State Department is, because when you think about the department,
75,000 people.
75,000 people in embassies and consulates spread around the world. 50,000 are locally employed staff at our embassies and consulates around the world. It's really 25,000 people, 14,000 civil service, 14,000 foreign service, 11,000 civil service. This is my fourth cabinet department, and I've worked at the Justice Department, Defense Department, and Commerce Department, each of which is much bigger than 25,000 people. And in addition, what I've found is everyone here, there's such a sense of, it's almost like a small town. Everyone knows one another. People who have served, and I served with so-and-so in Cairo, and remember, you and I were
roommates
in Baghdad.
I get that one a lot.
Roommates in Baghdad. It really is a small, tight-knit, in some ways, community, which sounds odd to say about an enormous cabinet department, but I do get that sense that people know one another and care for each other, particularly when you've been abroad and served in, whether it's a hardship post, a post where there's high threat, or just being abroad as Americans, planting the flag, working at our embassy, and living there for 2 or 3 years, or 1 year if it's a more difficult post, really creates very tight bonds. And so it being exposed to that that culture, which I had some familiarity with, I've had relatives who've served in the Foreign Service, but to see it up close has been really inspiring.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.